Have we mentioned, by the way, all of these are Bible plays? I don't know if we mentioned that today.
It did creep in. There was a point earlier where I was going, we should probably mention that, but
they're Bible plays. Each it's a whole history of the entire world from a Christian perspective. So you start from creation, you end at doomsday, and there's a lot of Jesus in the middle.
Hello and welcome to the Beyond podcast. And today we are going to be talking about York, the York Mystery Cycle, and a modern performance of the cycle that will be occurring very, very soon, which hopefully you'll be able to hear more about in just a few moments' time. All the details, the trials, the tribulations, the difficulty of staging so large scale an event. But it's not happening in York, England, UK. It is happening somewhere else. So my guest is here to tell us all about that. My guest, who are you and what is your purpose in life?
My purpose in life seems to be to, not to put too fine a point on it, seems to be to think about how the entertainment that we partake in makes us who we are. And so studying the history of entertainment allows us to think outside of our current historical moment in a way that no other study can do. So that's what I've dedicated my life to. My name is Matthew Sergi. I am an associate professor of medieval drama at the University of Toronto in the Department of English. I specialize more broadly in medieval English drama performance and play. I'm calling from Toronto right now. I'm really grateful that you're having me on your podcast. And I'm also the general manager for the York Plays 2025 project, where we're taking these York plays that were done in a huge production in the 15th and 16th centuries, a little bit of the 14th century in York. And we are putting it on in as close to medieval style, medieval huge style as we can, on the campus of the University of Toronto, actually Victoria University at the University of Toronto, on June 7th, which is coming soon, Saturday, June 7th, rain date, June 8th. So that's what we're up to.
This is a modern version. There are going to be all sorts of questions that come into what you do with a very old bit of literature.
Yes, indeed.
A bit of dramatic literature like this. So let's start with what was it like then before we go to what you're doing with it now. I think it's perhaps the best way of leading us into it. What was York within... within the medieval world?
Yeah, it's a great question, and it's hard to know where to begin, so I guess the beginning is the right place. What we know about these incredible and by modern standards deeply, deeply unusual ways of doing plays comes to us not from the play texts themselves first, but from the records, from the incidental records of finances, of legal proceedings, etc., that people in the medieval world left behind because they were keeping them safe for you know, administrative purposes. So the first record we have of someone doing a play like this comes from a rental of, it's funny I should be saying this because this is a question that's really come up in the production we're doing now. The place to store where these pageant wagons are housed when they're not in use. Right now we're struggling to figure out where we're going to put our own for exactly that reason. And so I know what kind of a paper trail that leaves behind. I should probably say what a pageant wagon is, for starters. When we talk about a pageant wagon, and there's different ways of putting it, I'll call it pageant wagon for today. It is basically a stage on wheels. It's pulled by humans. We have records from various places of people being paid to be putters, that is, the people who put the wagon in its place. And so we're talking about, you know, well before any purpose-built theaters were built in England, right? That comes up, I believe, in 1567. It's when the Red Bull opens in London. So we're talking like well before this, and of course, well before the 1520s as well. So there's no real precedent for a theater building happening. And so in order to get the show to the people, if you are putting together a show, you have to have something else that you built. And what was built in medieval York, for instance, and in other places, were stages on wheels. These would each be kept by one of the guilds of the town, and then when the performance began, would be rolled from station to station. They would roll the wagon, each guild often competitively would decorate their wagon with whatever set pieces of the play that they were doing. And then they would parade it, parade style, through the town and stop at strategic locations where the wagon would be braked, and then the performance would happen, and then he would roll the wagon on. So that means that each of these plays would repeat at each of these wagon stations. And so you'd be looking at every year, and I'll talk about the year, when they would do this in the year in a moment, every year on Corpus Christi Day, each of the plays in the Corpus Christi plays, the York plays, would be repeated probably about 12 times, each time in a different location. And those locations through the city of York were separated by the equivalent of an American football field. So we're talking about 100 yards or so, varied from place to place. So the first record we have of the York plays happening was in 1376, which is the receipt that someone has for one building in which three Corpus Christi pageant wagons are housed, which was 2 shillings per year in 1376. And that's recorded for that space. From there, we get an increasing number of references to the York plays that are happening. That's continuing on every year on the holiday that comes sometime in, it's a movable feast, but it's sometime in late May or throughout most of June on Corpus Christi Day. So it's really around, you know, near to midsummer, if not at it. And these are done every year, as far as our records show, at least as far as we can see, going from place to place across these 12-ish stations. This continues for many decades until we get to the beginning of the 15th century. And we have a record, our most important record, or one of the most important records we have from 1415, where in one of the civic books, someone has thought to write down the full order of the pageants of the play of Corpus Christi in order for the city to keep it in their records. By that point, then, in the 1415, what we call the Ordo Paganarum record, we have a record of all of the different plays that were being done. So keep in mind that these plays were each repeated about 12 times in the day. And the number of plays that are recorded in this record are either 52 or 57, depending on which of the internal list you're looking at. So that is up to 57 separate plays, each on a separate wagon, that is repeated 12 times through the city. This is obviously a full day event. The texts that survive, and there are 47 plays that survive in a manuscript that's written down later in the 15th century, the text of the plays that survive suggests a running time that was between 20 and 30 minutes per play, though it varies very widely, and some of the plays are very short and some of the plays are very long. But that math has been a major debate throughout medieval drama scholarship of how they could even fit this all into one day. It seems to be clear, and there's a lot of disagreement over this, and I've actually just recently published in research on medieval and Renaissance drama my take on the how did they do it in one day debate. But we're looking at these plays, these mobile plays that are repeated from station to station, each one about a different Bible story, starting at 4:30 a.m. and continuing into the wee hours of the following morning.
And the advantage of doing it at that time of year is of course, that they are long days and hopefully less chance of rain, though in practical terms, probably quite a lot of rain.
So I'm going to write now, I'm knocking on a literal piece of wood, and I ask that anybody listening, please knock on wood, pray to whatever you believe in, that we do not have much rain on the weekend of the 7th and 8th in Toronto. Who knows? But, you know, that would really tank things a lot for us. And yeah.
Yes. And touching on your point you were making earlier, and I can't remember if this was all on camera, on mic or before.
Yeah.
But the practicalities, the physical culture that we're talking about here, the pageant wagons themselves, but also settings, props, costumes.
Yes.
All of those elements are a resource that York presumably accumulated and expanded upon over time, had to somehow store, revive, keep turning over, adjust for different, if someone wanted to tweak a play or tweak casting.
Exactly.
So it's about a continuum. And the logistical problem that you've got, of course, is that you're not necessarily functioning within a continuum of practice. You have a practice that goes back at Toronto with these texts and with this kind of staging and these kinds of experiments.
Yes.
But it's not continuous, is it?
It has not been, and there have been various bumps on that road. What's instructive about this project and about what's instructive about it as a work of study into history, into cultural history, into entertainment history. And I say history of entertainment, not history of theater, very consciously, because this is not happening in theaters. And it's important. But that's another point we can talk about. But Toronto, as far as I know, right now, these plays are done by the York Heritage Trust in York proper once in a while, but they have not been done in York straight through. They're done also often on wagons in the streets of York, but there's only so much that the city itself can now accommodate in its modern framework. And as the York Heritage Trust and the York Mystery people have, as far as I know, reported, it really has shown them how massive even doing a truncated version of the plays can be in this station by station format. You mentioned the ongoing tradition at Toronto, and that's part of why I'm here. I'm a New Yorker originally myself, where I come from the suburbs of New York City. And so I came to the University of Toronto specifically because it has resources like this for the field I study. One of the main claims to fame here is the Records of Early English Drama Project, which has been an ongoing project since the 1970s, where they have been gathering records like the ones I talked about earlier, records of early English drama, things that witness the actual productions of the plays rather than just being the scripts from them, which survive in a much more scattered fashion, though all of it's pretty scattered. That's here at Toronto. And also here at Toronto is PLS, which has alternately stood for many things. PLS, whether you want to call it Pocoli Ludique Societas, or whether, which is Latin for the Cup and Game Society, or as we're starting to call it more now, Performance-Led Scholarship. It's a research-based performance company that takes the studies we're doing into early entertainment and puts them on their feet so that we can learn about them better. PLS has been doing this at Toronto also since the 70s. The 70s were great in Toronto. Things have changed. Things have changed over the last however many years. I was speaking to a builder, actually, and he's like, well, what did you do at the last production? And I was like, I don't know. I was in high school during the last production. I had no idea. So PLS has boasted, among other things, many productions, including productions on replica wagons that PLS started, that they built in 1977. The problem is that in 2022, there was a fire in campus storage that had been storing PLS's wagons and quite a bit of other material that, as you say, had accumulated from year to year. That fire was absolutely devastating, destroyed everything. We ended up valuing what it would cost to rebuild all of what PLS lost in that fire would be over $280,000 Canadian now. And it's something that's accumulated over really generations. We were able to get some insurance coverage through campus insurance, though in doing so, PLS's status with relation to the university was sort of revealed to be in a gray area. But we did get half of it covered, and then that half is going toward the rebuild of what we had was 11 of these wagons that we were using in performance. We can now barely afford to remake 4. Mm. So we'll be using those 4 for our June production. Assuming that everything gets built on time, we'll be doing those. But as you said, right, it's this sense of accumulation, things accumulating over the years. That's indeed how the scripts of plays like these were built, through accumulation from many hands year to year. And so it's a really generationally collaborative endeavor. And it's been really informative to participate in that, particularly the fire, to realize how ephemeral even the permanent things can be over that long stretch of time. It humanizes the kind of struggles that you see in the records of early English drama, where they're worried about one issue or another that comes up. You read about these in history books, but you don't experience them as much as we have now. We know what it's like to lose everything and have to rebuild.
Yes, because you've got records over time as well, but the actual performance texts are much more fixed in a moment, whereas other mystery cycles, their texts are much more fluid and much more complex, in the sense you have the advantage of this snapshot.
It's a snapshot, yeah.
Of what the drama looked like, 1463, 70-ish, something around there.
Yeah.
And so that gives you a sort of nice target and a sense of where you are, which sometimes the pure mass of where, you know, for example, the listeners benefit, you know, a cycle like Chester, right, which fundamentally changes its USP by going from being a 1 day to a 3 day and then we also can see the textual interventions that happen as the Reformation is coming into play, and it's just like, how do you stage an experiment on that when you're not really sure where you're standing?
Yeah. A sidebar to that, because Chester is where I sort of I cut my teeth on the Chester Place. That's my monograph that's out is about Chester. I think that the distance, I mean, definitely as it grew from 1 day to 3 day, that's a big change. But also keep in mind that the 3 day performance at Chester is nowhere near the kind of marathon performances that are happening on a single day at York, right? They're doing, I think it's 996 toward the end, right, of plays. And so that's much more, I think the word is sane, what they're doing over 3 days at Chester. And so the change that happened over time with the Chester plays, because our Chester play texts are mostly not entirely late, we do have one play from during the performances, The Antichrist at Chester, which I've written on. I think the distance from, say, the 15th century version to the 16th century version of the Chester plays has been overdetermined somewhat by scholars prior to me. We can see a lot of evidence of attempts to also fix it, and as I've written, there's been for all of the tendency to continually update the plays that did exist, there was also a real strong sense of nostalgia that helped fix the plays, which explains why the one play that we do have from Chester, which is The Antichrist, we have that play from the late 15th century in a standalone copy. That standalone copy differs from the 100 years later copy of the plays in the main script, but not by very much, which suggests that there was a real preservationist push to keep the plays unchanging as much as the plays continue to change. So that sort of destabilizes the destabilization theory in some ways, but in ways that make nothing easier. Moving to York, meanwhile, except in one case, we have one copy of all of the plays. There's one play that we have a separate copy of, which I can talk about in a minute. But that copy we call the York Register. That manuscript was copied down sometime between 1463 and 1477, and that's where we get the manuscript of almost all the York plays, with some exceptions. For one thing, we have the Scrivener's Doubting Thomas play, which also survives in a standalone copy from the early 16th century. And again, there's not so much change. There are some small and significant changes, but not that much, though that one's also pre-Reformation. Then we also have the York Register itself, which, as I said, was inscribed 1463 to 77, but has a host. It was a text in use. So it has a wide range of marks and changes that were made to it over time. Probably the most significant change being the insertion of the purification play, the play of Mary's purification, which actually, for that reason, is really a late 16th century version of the play. So that's also shoved in there. Stage directions here and there, little shifts here and there that are made to the manuscript, sometimes recognizable as such, sometimes not as easy to parse, that go through. So even the text that we have, that snapshot, it's an annotated snapshot. It's a snapshot that has sort of been messed with a bit over time itself.
Well, it's that continuity question again. The reason a text might resist change is, of course, if you've got someone who's always plays X part and they continue playing X part for 20, 30 years,
right,
then they're not going to want anyone changing the script because they know the script.
Exactly. Though they may accidentally change it themselves, right? And this falls into that sort of weird Parian Lord orality idea where what an oral culture registers as an exact replication of what we've always done is not the same thing as what a sort of photographically or digitally based culture would recognize as an exact replica. And I actually think that's informative because from where I'm standing, I don't think either model of exactitude is really superior to the other. I think a living sense of reproduction and ongoing doing things as we have always done them, though it would not necessarily match up to a video as we have always done them, might actually be a truer way to do historical reproduction than, say, doing it from a video, which of course has its own inherently flattening effects, right? This very form that we're speaking in, right? The recorded forms give the illusion of a kind of exactitude that cultures prior to this technology really couldn't conceive of. And part of the reason they couldn't conceive of it is because the exactitude of this is illusory. The idea that, you know, when you're doing a version of a live performance that you have a video of, and thus you know you're doing it as they did, so much of it has been eviscerated from that performance that the actual actor's experience of it would not lose. So, I don't know, there's something to say about that.
Yes, and we are, you know, we're in a for the most part in a pre-print culture. You know, these are manuscript texts.
That's important too.
And this is something that I, you know, as a practical theatrical practitioner is something I leap onto, because it's like, if you've done a show and you've gone on tour with the show and it's not based on, you know, somebody else's script, you know, it's something you've created.
Right.
The text frequently has no connection with what you're performing at all.
Oh, yeah.
Now,
yeah,
this is a much more regulated thing. There are more checks and balances in terms of people are checking, you know, your lines, and there are people making sure that it is appropriate. But even so, it's a practical medium. Going back to your point about, you know, that, you know, this isn't theatre in terms of entertainments within a theatre environment. You know, medieval drama is producing things where they want to, where they think it will work, ways they think it will work. And I often say to the early modernists, you know, early modern theatre, it's just sort of ossified medieval drama, really. I mean, you've just sort of lost all the originality and thought about, you know, site-specific performance.
That's right. I actually really do feel that way. I think even more than ossified, it's commodified, right? I mean, in many ways, it's commodified. You are putting early modernity comes in, and you're putting in a wall around it, and you're putting a permanent structure in it, putting it into a permanent structure, and that permanent structure is now the place where these things occur. It's very parallel to the rise of print, actually, the way that texts were circulated, you know, both orally and in writing before the technology of print comes in, is similar to the way that plays could circulate with both a sense of freedom and flexibility and also a sense of, you know, immense loss of creativity, right? It was a very entropic system before theater became proto-professionalized, became located indoors, or rather located consistent. Indoors is the wrong word. Because, of course, there were indoor productions, many indoor productions prior to this, right? But rather the idea that it was in a purpose-built, closed-off building for that purpose alone. That means that it becomes more locatable, it becomes more controllable. And indeed, it is controlled, right? The only reason the Puritans could shut down the theaters in the 1640s and 50s is because there were theaters to shut down. They could be controlled, again, for some good purposes, for the control of plague, for instance. But at the same time, right, and we're something that's not something with which we are familiar now. But at the same time, it means that and something also with which we're familiar now is the intrusion of these technological controls into live performance mean that the live performance itself shifts in its aesthetic and its soul, because it is in a more controlled, commodifiable, and indeed policed form. I don't think that that's going on in medieval performance. I think that medieval performance is more freewheeling than scholars even have really appreciated.
It's that medieval performance isn't interested in genre in the way that commercial theatre is, because genre is about how do you sell a play to an audience. Whereas a medieval audience is going, there's a play on. Here, shall we see it? Yes.
Yep.
And that's basically because there isn't choice in the same sort of way.
No, exactly. For instance, you get the announcements before certain medieval plays, like the bands, we call them. And these bands have erroneously been called advertisements. Well, not exactly, because for one thing, when you advertisement generally happens, it's not the same thing as an announcement, right? An advertisement, a particularly commercial advertisement, is something that's done competitively to try to earn, to try to sort of get someone to come to your store rather than the other guy's store. And it participates in, and the reason why I make that correction is because when we look at the records of early English drama, these bands tend not to be associated with money spent, but with money gained. The bands seem more often to be fundraising asks that are going out into the community saying, this is something in which we all have a stake.
Yeah.
This is what we've got to entertain ourselves. So this is the pre-entertainment that we're putting out there to show you that you should donate to this. This is for our parish or for our community or for our group. Throw some money our way so that, you know, not only to let you know that it's happening. And again, like, you know, there's a big performance happening in your relatively small network, you probably know it's happening. So not only to alert you that it's happening, but also to get people involved as funders, because it's, we talk about consumers, right? And the idea of a commercial consumer is really fundamentally linked to our own, the metaphor is of digestion, right? You consume something that someone else gives to you, you put it in your body, and then you poop out what you don't need. And that's how money is made, right? But the model for medieval performance is more like circulation. The idea that something is moving through and through and cycling around and cycling around. And in so doing, it picks up the nutrients and continues and improves the health of the community that way, or the finances of the community that way. More people get involved. They come out. They tend to buy things when they're out. It increases networking. It's a very nice model as well.
So making York happen today. So it's a scaled project in the sense of, are there specific sort of research aims in terms of trying to, with a project like this and what you're trying to achieve with the pageant wagons that you've got?
Yes, there are specific but manifold research aims. Let me start by saying, just because I feel like I need to say this a lot of times during this interview, the York Plays are happening in Toronto. You can go to our website, yorkplays.ca. Speaking of commercialism, but I'm not making any money off of this, right? Though we are raising money for the wagon replacement to recover from the fire and to fund future productions like this. So if you do want to donate to us, we'd greatly appreciate it. You can find links to that through yorkplays.ca as well.
And also links to all of this will be in the show description.
So yeah, come see it. The performances, just like at York, will start in the early morning. Sunrise is not as early in more southerly Toronto. And not only that, but you can't ask actors to show up at 4:30 a.m. anymore. And yeah. So we'll be starting at 6 a.m. sharp and continuing probably till after midnight. We're going all day on wagons that we are reconstructing. Anyway, you asked about research goals. The bracket to this is that we have so many different groups involved with the productions coming from all across North America. Each of them has their own goals, and they're bringing that to their plays. We have specifically multiple university groups. So that's Fordham University, CUNY Brooklyn College, Claremont McKenna College, University of Tennessee, Knoxville, Radford University, Loyola Marymount University. I'm looking at the list. We have Shenandoah University. University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign. Also, North Park University is involved, and Our Lady Seat of Wisdom College. I think I've named them all. Forgive me if I've forgotten any. All of these are different academic groups. There's not only academic groups, but each of them often has a scholar artist that's involved. And those scholar artists are each investigating their own set of questions. University of Calgary is another scholar who's contributing to this. So, for instance, Professor Jacqueline Jenkins from University of Calgary is particularly interested in understanding how gender plays with Abraham and Isaac stories. And so she is working with the Abraham and Isaac play, and you'll see some of her research questions emerging in that particular production of the plays. Whereas John Sebastian at Loyola Marymount University, his questions have particularly been engaging with music. And also, I think, with questions about how music and devotion transfers across cultures. So you'll see influences in his Annunciation play and his other plays having to do with the Virgin Mary that draw a lot on music and a lot on influences from non-English sources for music. So everybody brings in their own research. But at the administrative level, we have two main research questions that these plays are at least opening up on the Toronto side. One of them is a straightforward one. It's a question about the wagons. This is being led off by my own research assistant and current master's student at the Center for Medieval Studies here, Arya Kowal, who has been working very diligently with the builder and otherwise to look into both secondary and primary sources about wagons, both at York and places beyond, to try to revise what the wagons looked like in a way that's really, really closely in keeping with the records that we do have, which are sparse, but which are informative. And so she's been doing a lot of cool work there since we, you know, out of fire comes opportunity here, since the wagons do need to be rebuilt. And the old wagons were built with what they had. They were actually decommissioned farm wagons that were built for the purpose. We struck a committee involving scholars new and older, including Alexander F. Johnston and Phil Butterworth. Philip Butterworth is actually a UK scholar as well, and he is incredibly knowledgeable about the practicalities. I'm sure you've come across Philip Butterworth before.
Oh, yes.
Yes. And so...
I'm staring at staging conventions as we speak.
Yes, yes. He's a wealth of knowledge, and he's particularly concerned with the authenticity of wagons. So we've been talking about that with him, negotiating with him. He wants our wagons to not be able to turn. For instance, he believes that pudding stanks were used to sort of jimmy the wagon across turns, which then we pitched to our builder, and the builder was like, absolutely not, for safety reasons. So it's been a back and forth, right? And so we're figuring out a way, right? So the final version of these wagons we are trying to build in a way to disable the turning mechanism so that people can, in later years, not at this particular production, practice with that. So we're really trying to lean into this reconstruction of the wagons. Though, of course, there have been hurdles. I can't know for sure the final state of what this research project will look like in June. We're hoping that we'll have at least a replica of the Mercer's wagon from 1433, of which a record survives and was found by Johnston herself. So we'll see. That's sort of what started the Records of Erling Nostromo project in the first place. So we're really drawing on that. One of the things that has been particularly controversial is the position of the wagons in terms of how they sit in the street. There has been a debate that's been happening. It's actually, from a staging history perspective, it's really pretty fascinating. It's the new thing that has been blowing my mind. This question of end-on or side-on performance. We have these rectangular wagons. We're pretty darn sure they were pretty rectangular because we do have records of care for their wheels, for instance. And we have that at Chester as well. And so we can put together that these were roughly rectangular rather than, say, square wagons, which means one end was longer than the other. There have been various guesses based on the records, but mainly based on the layout of York's medieval streets, which are mostly still relatively intact, and where the wagons would have to go on the path that we know they had to go, about what their dimensions would be. There's a short end and a long end. The short end has generally been assumed to be around 6 feet, give or take more. But 6 feet seems to be what people have settled on. And the long end has been guessed at, I think, we're using 10 feet. Some people have guessed 12. Some people have guessed a little shorter. But I think 6 by 10 is safe. So we're using a 6 by 10 model. So that seems pretty straightforward. But the question is, which side is downstage? Mm-hmm. And I was assuming myself, because I have a background in theater, and I use that word consciously, right? My background is in theater. And when I have a box that I'm playing in, the long side is downstage because you have more staging area that way, of course. But when you're in a crowded street and you're pulling the wagon along, how do you then maneuver the wagon so that that downstage side plays to somebody more than just the crowd that could sort of squeeze in between the buildings on the opposite side of the street, which sometimes is quite tight, and the end of the wagon? That side-on orientation ends up creating a very unwieldy model for street performance that has sometimes caused prior scholars to deduce, well, I guess the audience that really mattered were the rich ones who were looking on from above. And okay, but depends on what you mean by mattered, and that'll get into my second research question, which maybe we'll talk about if I ever stop talking about this first one. But anyway, with Aria's help and drawing on the work of Meg Twycross, has made the case that really the end-on arrangement, the idea that you pull up the wagon in the street and the direction that the wagon was traveling is downstage, shifts your understanding of what it means to play on these wagons and play in the street drastically. It means that all of these plays are plays of depth in a way that we're not used to, that they're playing with the street, that they're truly site-specific in a way that doesn't cut against the flow, but rather uses the flow of the street. We see evidence of this we have some somewhat contemporary drawings of wagon performance from, say, Brussels, and they all seem to be doing end-on performance in those drawings. But we also just see that the utility of this, if the wagon does not have to turn, not only is it more convenient by far, not only is it better for crowds, but also it means that you can build the procession of the wagon truly into the show. The wagon processes forward, and you see the set approaching you. And then as it processes away, you see the back of it, which is also probably decorated in a way that's powerful. It does something, this end-on arrangement. It does something to at least my sense of how the space is working. And I don't know if this is transferable to Chester, where a lot of the streets are wider, et cetera. That's a complication that I don't want to, that's a can of worms I don't want to open up. But at York, it's pretty convincing that end-on orientation was used. So for our production on the campus, we will be turning the wagons so that the short end faces the, assumedly, where we think the audience will congregate. And often the other short end, the upstage end, will be facing, say, a wall or something like that. it has been a challenge for all of our modern performers to get used to the idea that the short side is downstage. But I think that challenge has been really informative in and of itself.
The other question is, I suppose, on that level is also how much street level is being used in York. Because there are plenty of texts that clearly dive onto the street or use street as a way of transitioning location to location. Is York doing something like that?
So that's been a point of everything's a point of debate, right? Yeah. So the prior productions that have been done, say at Toronto, have concluded that, and I'm not quoting directly, but the general vibe was that street level or plateau level performance was minimal. That of course it is a necessity to use the plateau, that is the street level, in staging, because the wagons are so tight and because they involve scene shifts and they involve moments where you bring on like a donkey or something that cannot go up onto the wagon. And so, and I'm not going to say I've written about this, but I did write about this at Chester. It doesn't matter. Like, so the plateau is the street level is a level you must use at some level. The question is how much. And my predecessors had deduced that because in their experience, using the street level too much dissipated the energy. That must have meant that these wagon pieces were generally more centered on the wagon only. I'm trying to push back on that quite a bit because, especially not only with End On production, but just in general, you got to use the street. Like it's a fundamentally, it's a deeply, deeply embodied form. And so you getting up there in the body, among the bodies is key. We see embedded cues throughout that say that they're clearly using levels. And while you can add levels to the wagons themselves, we're struggling to do so, but while you can add levels to the wagons themselves, those levels must be must by nature be very tight. There have been prior scholars who have thought that the wagons were roofed and thus would add another level on top. That just doesn't make any sense, because then you cannot view it except from directly, like that would be incredibly impractical for outdoor performance. So we're talking here really moving platforms plus maybe an extra level, which means that in order to open up plays with the kind of grandiosity that is involved, you need more. You need to use the street level. We have records from other plays. I mean, I've made the case about the Chester plays, that the Chester plays used street level really amply. You have the famous stage direction from the Coventry plays, where Herod is to rage on the pageant and then in the street, right? And so, you know, you have this guy simply in order to play the Mad King, he is freely moving from the wagon down into the street and then back. And so there's real free passage. So I think that the street level is used pretty amply. I think we'll have ample space to use on campus, and I've encouraged all the contributors to make use of it.
Well, it's also that sense, again, following on from our thoughts, you know, what we were talking about earlier about, you know, later drama being ossified by architecture. It's up to the individual pageant maker to a large degree what
most
they're
definitely
doing, and that actually having any kind of, you know, this is definitely the, or any kind of absolute position is sort of unhelpful, because it's going to be whichever problem you need to solve for this play is going to be the solution.
No, I buy that too. Because this is less ossified, as you said, it means that it's built on ideals that we would now associate with improvisation, with improv. Right. And not just sort of like, you know, yes and improv, but really the kind of improv that you know, postmodern theater artists like Mary Overly are doing, like the idea that or Gutowski or something, the idea that you really are building the act of play from the things that are available to you in the space. So assumedly, right, even within the city of medieval York, different staging practices would emerge for different stations, let alone different guilds. Different resources, different sizes of casts.
Yeah, the X station has a very annoying overhanging jetty or something, so they can't do what they did on further down the road, etc.
Right, exactly. And so when you are free, or station 8 has the VIPs watching from the mayor's office, or no, it's not the mayor's office at York. It's one particular. Oh, the Guildhall. The Guildhall at station 8. The Guildhall at station 8 at York has VIPs watching from up high. So for that one, y'all, you know, play to the rafters. Yeah. Like that kind of variation is built in. And when you are freed in the circulatory model of drama, when you're freed from having to be exactly repeatable because you don't have customers paying, you can really have more fun with that for better and worse. And so, yeah, I'd say so. The second research question that we are asking, again, from my home base, again, remembering that each of the other teams is bringing their own research questions, but mine coming in and sort of from the administrative level is the question of embodiment and presence and what it means to do plays like this truly live. What does the liveness of the plays do to our understanding of the plays? What these plays ask of our bodies in time and space do to our understanding that, say, a video recording could not do? This is sort of a reason for being for this experiment in the first place, because if we could, right, there have been a number of computer-based models, modeling of how the plays might have worked, various calculations on paper, arguments on paper about how they worked. And of course, the number of times these plays are read in classrooms in a sedentary position. What is it about this immense effort that we're putting in that teaches us something and offers us something that none of those other media can? So that research question, the why we're doing this, has been key for me. I mentioned earlier the work of Mary Overly, the inventor of the six viewpoints, which is a sort of, she calls it postmodern, call it what you will, but it's a present day performance practice and theory. It's very practically oriented about how we break down what a performance is, again, outside of the theater. She's one of many postmodern, anti-modern performance makers that, in pushing against modern traditions, has in some ways replicated what pre-modernity looked like to me. Grotowski is another big one. So in turning to her work with presence and with body and with space, and in turning to Grotowski's work, the Via Negativa, things like this, we're starting to ask questions at the scholarly level about what do we have to do to our own sense of perception in order to actually activate the exercise that we're doing to truly unlock something that we could not know through other media. And it's a really difficult question to ask. So these are questions that are primarily being asked by me and my work, and then by Professor Andrew Albin at Fordham University and Professor Lauren Mancia at CUNY Brooklyn College. All three of us have been working together on this, taking viewpoints classes, et cetera, for a couple of years now, to try to formulate how this question relates to the study of the past. And we did a very strange and very well-received panel at the Medieval Academy of America meeting at Harvard, the centennial meeting of the Medieval Academy of America, as a panel, really just last month, where each of us honed in on some element of our various fields of study that can only be understood by doing, and that simply talking about distorts. Lauren Mancia, she, for instance, looked at all the scholarly ways that monastic practices of foot washing, right, the foot washing ritual that was done by monks, has been talked about and analyzed, and pointed out what they missed, and then literally took out basins and washed the feet of attendees at the panel. It was incredibly vulnerable, incredibly moving. Andrew, who focuses on music as well, he did an exercise with the sonority of manuscripts by bringing us all into the making of sounds. And for my part, I did a monologue at that academic panel, which was a very vulnerable thing to do in the first place. But what I did was I honed in on the Overly work to try to, I basically did this monologue that Jesus says, where Jesus and the Doubting Thomas play, he appears to all the other apostles first. He appears to the apostles, and much as happens in Luke, I think, he scares the shit out of the apostles. Oh, can I curse? Can I cuss in these?
Yeah, that's fine. It's okay. That one's okay.
Okay, great. So he scares the shit out of the apostles. They see him. They just watched him horribly killed. He appears to them with his wounds still bleeding, and they go, oh my God, a ghost, right? And that happens in the Bible too. They get scared. And so he has to prove to them, I'm not a ghost. I'm the incarnation. As I promised you, I'm the incarnation of my, I'm here. This is my body. And so in scripture, he says, handle me, see me, handle and see that I'm really here. And if you don't believe that, I'll eat with you too. And I've already written a bit about how the eating also is deeply humanizing, and the eating would really be done on stage, on the wagon stage, that is. But this touching moment at York, Jesus takes that call to actually touch his body and repeats it three times in the space of eight lines. He says, gropus me noa. Grasp me now, or actually grope me now, though without the sense of like non-consensual touching. It didn't have that sense back then, but it did have the sense of caress, right? Grope had the sense of caress, of touch, of grasp, of wrestle with, in the sense of like wrestling with an idea, like I'm groping with the idea, right? Grappling with the idea. And so he is saying, in order to grasp what I am, touch my body. And they take this biblical command that's in the imperative in the Latin Vulgate, and they repeat it in different wording 3 times over and over and over again. And it's quite powerful when any actor does it, right? Because it's like, oh yeah, the actor's body is there. Congratulations. But is that an experience you could just as easily have by watching a YouTube video of the actor doing it? Fine. But when then you drop into presence, when you go away from the sort of like presentational commercial style and you deliver the monologue with the kind of presence work that Overly and Grotowski work on, the idea of not masking the truth of the actor's body or the truth of the actor's emotions through a character, but rather being in propria persona, being really there and yourself, as Sharon Anson Lahavi and others have written, was what the York players would have been doing. They wouldn't have been trying to convince someone that they were also Jesus, just like the 15 other Jesuses that had come on prior wagons. This is how Jim the Carpenter is Jesus. And he is him. And when you drop into that sense of presence, actually not just look at people, not just look them in the eye, but check in with the fact that, like, I'm Matt, I'm here. When you deliver that same speech, that's when you say, grope me now, grasp me, someone reaches out and touches your hand. Because it matters that you're there, because televisual media cannot replicate touch. And an entire play festival called Corpus Christi that's based on the actual body of the God that they believed in turns on the idea that our bodies being present together, whether or not we're actually physically touching them or just aware of their tangibility through our physical proprioception, is fundamental to the art form in a way that proscenium-based theater is not, and certainly in a way that televisual media is not. There are boundaries. There's no fourth wall to break. That's beyond, like, there's no walls. No. It's rather in and of people. And so in recreating that, it's not simply a matter of, oh, stick it on present day actors and they'll just do it, because present day actors are present day everybody. Our imaginations have been so overtaken by televisual media that we will put anything and everything in a box if given the opportunity. We have to be challenged out of it. And so when working with techniques and questions that open up how to make your body and yourself and your soul really there when you do this stuff in an honest and not annoying way, you know, we're not like offering the possibility of real communion and real community, not just a rehearsal of it or a simulation of it. When we do this, we've been challenging our various contributing groups in sort of semi-annoying ways to think about these questions throughout their rehearsal processes.
It was on a similar but different element in the sense of the endurance event of it all. So I was in Oxford this last weekend where they were doing their mystery plays, which is a very different scale of kind of event.
Yes.
But you're still there for 6-7 hours on your feet. Watching what's happening, and you know, you get to the end, you're absolutely knackered. And the actors for this kind of exercise would also be, because they're performing all day.
That's right.
And the audience are there all day. And yes, you can selectively drop out or decide how you're going to be there. But in theory, you have this endurance exercise that you have to go through to experience this work in a way that, again, you know, other kinds of media don't tend to do in this fashion.
Yes. What it asks of you, what it has already asked of me in organizing it, has been, to say endurance is an understatement. I mean, it's been really hard in many ways to deal with all of the moving parts. And part of that is because the 21st century world is particularly resistant. As I've sort of I've been trying to repeat to all of our participants, this is much harder to do now than it was in the 1970s. In the 1970s, one classic example is that the 1977 production of the York plays, also on the Toronto campus, they got rained out, right? It started pouring rain during the Noah play, which is kind of amazing. But anyway, got rained out in the Noah play. And so what they did was they just move the whole thing indoors. By which I mean they took a whole, I believe they took a whole wagon stage into the Convocation Hall on the University of Toronto campus, which is a massive, deeply expensive indoor space on Toronto's campus. Someone just let them in. Someone knew somebody. They knocked. They went in with their wet selves, sat their wet asses down, and continued on. And were disappointed, right? Because they didn't get to do the processional thing they had planned until it let up. But they did it there. I look back at accounts of that production and I go, in what universe would a university allow you to just walk in to their most prestigious, biggest, most expensive space and be like, oh yeah, no one's using it. Go ahead. Like, that is inconceivable today. In fact, we finally, after months and months of negotiation, were able to at least get the rental fee for our university space waived because we were officially housed within a university department. So using it for a scholarly event, right? But even then, with all of the fees for all of the different staff, all of the different dots and dot I's to dot and T's to cross, it's still maxing out the small grant I received in order to do this, in order to host it there. And then the idea that if we rain, we could just move in someplace big, I asked. And they were like, no. Right. So you hear about the 1970s production and random people from the community were coming in, sitting on wagons, like someone put their kid up on a wagon, sitting at Herod's feet. So he started playing to the kid, that kind of thing, you know, whereas if that happened now, well, unfortunately, 21st century circumstances mean that we have to have everybody who is touching a wagon sign a waiver and everybody who doesn't has to stay a meter away. Right? On and on. It's relentless. And so this is all to set up the statement that this is an exercise that is becoming increasingly impossible, even in living memory. It's certainly more impossible than it was when the mayor himself was involved in the 15th century, let alone 10% of the town. But what is making this increasingly impossible is what makes it increasingly necessary. The changes in our day-to-day understanding of space and how we relate to each other have changed in many ways for the worse. Sometimes, some ways for the better, but in many ways for the worse over those spans of time, both the centuries and the decades. And to take on this, the mass of what this dramatic piece asks of us is an exercise in becoming more conscious, defamiliarized with the ways that in little shifts, our attitude toward the spaces and university and cities in general with each other that we occupy. It makes us more aware of the space we're in, which is something for which I'm grateful, as hard as that realization has been at times.
Following on from your thought there about how difficult it is to put this on without the momentum and without the sort of ongoing sort of infrastructure that a cycle in the past would have had, it speaks also to how the end of mystery cycles, how that end functions, because you only need to not do it a couple of years. You only need that injunction to last a bit for it to become increasingly hard. And so, because there's lots of discussion about, how did that end come about and what was the primary driver? But I've always seen it as sort of a series of incentives and disincentives. There comes a point when the disincentives just get so high. And a lot of those are pragmatic, I think.
I mean, at York, that's the case. At Chester, people were still so gung-ho about it that they had to just officially get an inhibition from the Archbishop. The people of Chester still did it illegally twice after it was prohibited. And so that was when the mayor himself was called to the Star Chamber, had to report to the Privy Council, and was prosecuted by London authorities. I mean, that's like shutting the place down in Chester was a matter of just genuinely policing entertainment as a way of bringing forth what James Simpson calls a cultural revolution in the Reformation. Like, that's for sure. At York, I think you're right. I think it's a mix of factors, definitely. But one of the factors that's involved is the way that, choose my words carefully here, the way that tradition and basic sort of human community acts can be cut off by convincing young people that their increasingly restrictive attitudes are liberationary. Right? Young generations, and whoever's hearing me say this might interpret this one of two ways that are opposite to each other. So go ahead. Maybe both are true. But as we're seeing, I think the youngest generation of adults tends to be susceptible to thinking that whatever goes against what their forebears were saying or doing must be a move toward liberation. And so I think in 16th century England, the politics of the Reformation, and more appropriately, the politics of Puritanism, are convincing newer generations that this is the freest that they've ever been by being free of all of these old, stupid, sacrilegious ways of expressing your religious belief through your community and through your own body. And so you are freer and better off now that you're casting off that absurdity. And absurdity is indeed what one of the Puritan protesters in Chester called it, right? The absurdities of interpreting the Bible in this way. It doesn't say that in the Bible. Look at what I've written in print, right? And print coming out gives us this sense that repeatability is a different kind of thing. And so, yes, you're right. The sort of maneuvering that leads to the end of these plays is also aligns well with what makes the plays so difficult to do now. And I'm very conscious of that and pushing back against that. Yeah. So the people who debate that the York plays could never have been done in one day, they at first offer the idea mathematically, right? The people who say it couldn't be done, they say mathematically it couldn't have happened. You know, Alan Nelson famously did it in the 1970s. Then it happened again later where people were saying, well, mathematically, this doesn't make any sense. Just the amount of time it takes to do these plays and to transition between spaces would exceed a day. And they're right if you define a day as daylight. Daylight at midsummer in York, if you include what we call civil twilight on either side of it. So that's the sort of period on either side of sunrise and sunset where you can see pretty damn well. You have about, I think it's 18.5 hours of workable light. And they are absolutely right that mathematically the York plays could not fit into that period. But we also have records from the Records of Early English Drama where various groups are complaining that their plays had to be done in the dark. One group is complaining that their play had to be done in the dark, the Masons. And so given that that complaint is at all conceivable, then that means that playing in the dark could and did happen. Maybe some people weren't happy about it, but the Masons went near toward the end, but the Mercers always went last and they were very happy about it. They were the most powerful guild in the town. So the assumption is that if the delays that the Masons are complaining about cause the Masons play to go after civil twilight or after dusk in a way that they didn't expect, but it kept happening, then the plays that went well after the Masons surely were expecting to be in dark. You see my logic. And so the idea is we're basically not bound. What it is that it clearly signals that the lighting was there. There's after all a torch procession associated with the plays often, though whatever, we can't necessarily associate them, but that doesn't mean that the torches are not there. There are torches in the town, obviously. And so lighting it by firelight seems to be an acceptable thing to do. And with that opened, the question of whether you can mathematically fit it into daylight no longer is a question. The question of whether you can fit it into, say, a 24-hour period, no one has ever debated. And so, except, I think it's the early 15th century, right around where there are like 57 of them, where you have people of York going, guys, if you keep adding stations, we can't get this done in one day. Right. So like you have like that anxiety back then, too, which is kind of brilliant. When the mathematical concerns about whether they can fit fall away, many scholars end up saying things like, but you can't. Who would want to do this? It's so tiring. It's so exhausting. In fact, there's one scholar in particular, Margaret Rogerson, also Margaret Durrell in earlier publications, who went from definitely saying these plays had to be done maximally to how could they be done after I've seen it done in York? After I've seen it done in Toronto, in Leeds, you can't do this. You can't do this all day, but you could feel the exhaustion coming through. And that dovetails back into these questions about physical presence, physical engagement that I'm asking. For one thing, the plays are arranged in their original context where every play was done by a different guild. So no team of players is really in use for that big a chunk of the whole thing. And there are 12 different stations. So end time at station 1 and start time at station 12. Like there's a big gap there considering we're repeating each of these plays at each of these 12 stations. So the length of the day is perceived differently. And the assumption is that people can really come and go as they please, that you're not sitting through this the way you would through a theatrical production, that you're watching it, that you're in it probably, or someone you know is in it. So you're going to follow that one. But above all of that, it's exuberance. When you ask theater people, and again, I'm using that term consciously here. When you ask theater people, about the process of doing an 18.5 or longer hour production, you get quotations like the one that I'll read from, say, Arlen DeBoyer, who is an excellent scholar who published, who's really more an early modernist, but who has published on the question of the York plays and the production, where she says, a question worth asking ourselves is whether a playing day of what she says is over 20 hours. And it's fair to say, right, a play that you aim to be 18.5 hours will probably take at least 20. A question worth asking ourselves is whether a playing day of over 20 hours, this is quoting Boyer, even if possible, would be practical or entertaining or desirable. That the event would be any of the three is not at all apparent, nor from any point of view, that of the performers, that of the audience, or that of the city. In short, whether or not the York Guilds could successfully stage a 20-hour marathon extended beyond daylight at both ends, one wonders why they would do such a thing. That's her writing, right? End quote. So the question of why is tied in with the question of endurance. And to open up that question, I decided to stop asking theater people and scholars because, finish that sentence yourself. And instead asked a burner, someone who goes to Burning Man every year. He's a little older than me. And I was like, I've never been to Burning Man. Burning Man is the week-long art festival that happens in Nevada every year. And I asked him, why in the world do you do this? What's involved? He ended up saying some things that he didn't want to be totally public about. So we're using his burner name, which is Tinker. So Tinker told me, and I've published some of this interview again in Rome Art and Research on Medieval and Renaissance Drama. But he started saying things to me where I was moved. I mean, I started crying. Right. I'm almost going to start crying about it now. Right. So he says things like, first off, the fact that at this Burning Man festival, they have these art cars, which are essentially mobile stages for various weird things that they do. Right. That's built in, the kind of thing. But he says he arrives. He says the festival really starts on the prior Sunday night and builds a whole week until it gets to Saturday. But he usually gets there the Wednesday before that. So he's there a week and a half to set up camps, install our installations, to work, to help the Burning Man effect happen. He's built into the labor and he's laboring the whole time. When he's there, right, everybody turns off their phones or your phones don't work. So your sense of time turns into what he calls a natural organic blur. And I'm quoting here now, quoting Tinker, the place runs 24 hours a day. So what pattern you send depends on what you like to do. The longer I'm there, the more nocturnal I get. He says, it literally goes 24 hours a day. It certainly goes hardcore until 4 a.m. The evening parties start around 8 p.m. maybe, go all the way to sunrise, but then a huge art car all of a sudden sets up at 8 a.m. He says, everybody tends to go harder and harder as you approach the big burn festival at the end, or the big burn ritual at the end. He says, it's very much a sleep when you're dead kind of thing. I've been known to get going very hard at 10 a.m. on burn day, the final day, and not call it a quit until 10 a.m. the next morning. Matt, I'm 52 years old, right? He says, this is not an academic, calm, holy crap. What the 20-year-olds pull off, I can't imagine how long some of them just keep trucking. The original old school crowd, they're in their 70s now. Plenty of octogenarians at Burning Man who bring their babies. This isn't about a week for so many people. It's a 52-week-a-year event. I'm only there a week, but the other 15 weeks, I'm building, I'm prepping. And so you build it in because you love it and you care. When I asked him what Boyer asked, which is, why would you do such a thing? Why? Why would you keep running hard for an arts festival for 24 hours in your early 50s? He said something that really moved me. I said, why would you stay up all night? Why would you keep going? He said, because it ends on Monday. You know, this is me quoting him. You only get so much time there, so you sleep when you're dead. There's so much to do, so much going on. For me, it is quality time with some of my favorite people. It's the only time I ever see them. So especially as you pull into the end, as soon as someone comes up with another suggestion of something fun to do, why would you go to sleep? There are just too many entertaining options that are all going to completely stop existing the moment they close the gate. So if someone gives you Disney World all to yourself and the lines are gone, that's not the day you take a nap. That's the day you power ride until you can't walk anymore. And for me, it's just about getting every drop you can out of the tank. End quote. So that brings up two questions. One is the question of seeing people for the only time in year. And you would think, oh, you see all these people in York all the time. Not so. Lots of tourists are coming to York for this event. And we have records of specific people concerned about making sure everybody can see the plays because people have come so far to see this. And also what he says about expending the tank, what drives Tinker is that he loves it, is that he's having fun, is that he cares so much about it and he has waited all year for it to happen. Well, that's the same thing that's causing people in the early 15th century to add random stations when it's already so exhausting. And it's something that thus far, it seems, none of our reconstructions have really grasped that it has to make, in order to make sense, you have to be present and yourself and really be having a genuinely good time in order to justify what you're doing, or else there's no point.
Yeah.
And so you get stamina from that.
Yeah. And the you know, this... So I had a very naughty thought there just about academics and stamina. I'm just thinking, have you not been to a conference before?
No, but that's what the, can I talk about that?
Yeah.
Right. What a conference is, what an academic conference is. First off, academic conferences are so increasingly awful, right? Because they're so big, there's so much going on, and nobody actually is going to anybody's panel. Because if, think the morning panels. I was so pleased that our panel was well attended at MAA, because usually we had an 8 a.m. on the Saturday panel, and in my experience, the 8 a.m. on the Saturday panel, nobody fucking wants, right? Like, right. So you worked on this all year or whatever, and you're presenting, and then you're presenting to a room in the basement of whatever university for like three people. Like, people show up to conferences, but they don't show up there mainly for the academics, frankly. They show up for the camaraderie, right?
Yeah.
Have I spent the whole night awake with various people at academic conferences? Yes. Yes, absolutely. And then I've crashed the next day, but I only get to see them once a year. So we do know what that feels like. It's just, we know what that feels like outside of the rooms in which we actually do our thinking. It's the one thing I said about the Chester plays way back is that the cast party and the production are not separable, right? The cast party is continuous with the production.
Yeah.
They're all part of the same thing. We have this tendency in commodifiable theater and commodifiable academia to take the fun stuff and the socialization and say, well, that's secondary to it. The real thing is X. And then we only look at the real thing and we miss the point entirely. But yeah, we have our ways of staying up all night. It's just, we don't want to tell anybody that's what we did, because then we'd have to say why we missed the 8 a.m. session.
Yeah.
So, you know.
And again, there's speaking to, you know, a lot of our work, which is often feels like endurance work, in the sense that often we will program a week of shows back to back that,
right,
you know, and right, it's just like, and yes, it's ridiculous. Why are we doing all of these shows? Because otherwise it's not an event. It's not, it's not what we're doing. And we want to do as much as possible rather than just let's do a play, you know?
Yeah. I mean, think about stock, right? You have a summer stock in the UK. Is that what you call it?
Yeah, like less so these days, but
it
does sort of exist in some places.
Again, what makes it less and less possible is what makes it more and more necessary. But like, if you think about the thrill of being in a stock company who's doing like a production, you know, every 2 weeks, and they're putting it together, it's enthralling and incredible to be asking to be doing that, and everybody complains about it, but then they're actually doing it, and it's deeply invigorating. They find the stores of energy because that's what they love. The only problem is that most theatrical techniques now have trained all these actors to mask their exhaustion from the audience, because the audience are paying customers, and so they're essentially expecting to see something of the same quality and the same type and same style that they could see on Netflix. One wonders why don't they just stay home and watch Netflix, and they mostly do. But the thing is, like, what you're going for, the experience you're going for, has to make your own discomfort and your own exhaustion and your own intensity visible as you, not as a product. If you open that up, you open up possibilities of what this art form can be. And I'm tired of seeing polished productions that look the same to me as they look to all of the other subscribers or blah, blah, blah. Like, I could get that at home with Netflix. I'm pretty tired of Netflix, too. If I'm going to go and see live bodies in a room, let them be live. Let it be different every time.
Okay. Text. Let's talk text.
The York text, as we said, is written down in a manuscript in the 1460s or 70s. And that text has undergone change and it continues to change. It's all written in Northern Middle English, which is very difficult even for readers of Chaucer sometimes to parse. So we have this text. It's written primarily mostly in verse. The verse form changes within plays and from play to play. From there, we have updated spelling additions, which at least take the Middle English text and take all of the words that you could basically just understand by spelling differently, right? Updating their spelling, and make them more readable that way, and then gloss the difficult words, change some key words with an eye toward keeping true to the text, but also making it more readable. This is work that has been done, I think, in a pioneering way with medieval texts by Christina M. Fitzgerald, who is a scholar at the University of Toledo. Christina Fitzgerald put out a Broadview edition of, I think it's 27 of the extant plays called, the York Corpus Christi Play Selected Pageants, that are all done in that style. That is the base text that we're using for those 27 plays. And then, probably in one of the most important developments in our project, we brought Professor Fitzgerald, Christina Fitzgerald, on board. And she has, for the purpose of our York 2025 production, updated the remaining 20 pageants specifically for the purpose of our production. So they're entirely internal. You won't hear them anywhere else except at our production. From there, each group gets to do with that Fitzgerald edition what they wish. The edition has already been updated in spelling, but an edition that stays pretty true to the York Register manuscript. From there, I've challenged each group to treat the text in a way that makes the most sense to them, because I think that's the most historically accurate thing to do, is to give the guilds some freedom here, because the guilds intervened in their texts, certainly. And so what I've challenged each group to do is to either just do the Fitzgerald text as is, but to do so in a way that is understandable and, you know, reachable by the audience, or to update it further into modern language that makes sense to them, while following a set of rules that make sure that they're still saying what's in the text. They are allowed to, and I'm, how can I enforce this? But, you know, I can enforce this with nagging, which is what I do a lot. Another endurance art. The rules are, any word in the York plays must correspond directly and straightforwardly with 1 to 3 words in your version. So you can expand it a bit, but you can add something that's not there. So for instance, you know, I don't know, if I wanted to say, you know, God, and I instead said the big guy or the big boss or something like that, right? Much like what Miranda Devana Headley does with Beowulf. That is acceptable as long as you're staying true to the original. You cannot add any word that is not attached to a word from the original text. That's what we're keeping people to. I've encouraged some people to, thus, in doing that kind of update, to play with rhyme, to try to get some, because we lose the rhyme in the updated spelling edition for obvious reasons. And so, at least in the text that I've had more direct contact with, I've tried to squeeze the text around, update it to a degree where I can recreate rhymes that are audible.
Except in the cases where the manuscript itself has been damaged. There are definitely some places, including 3 whole plays, where the manuscript that we have from the 1460s or 70s has been damaged enough that text has been visibly lost. And so in those places, we've challenged the participants to come up with replacements for the lost text on their own and insert it where that damage is. So there will be some stuff created anew, but only in those places of loss.
So some of the plays will be doing that. Each of the plays will be doing something different. A lot of them will just be using the Fitzgerald updated spelling edition straight. And we're very, very grateful to Christina F. Fitzgerald for being our resident editor of our text. It's really exciting that she's doing that.
And this is one of those awful segues. If you'd like to hear more from Fitzgerald about the published York plays, you can go to the episode on our podcast. We recorded that when it was published.
That's fabulous. Yeah, and we'll be, and Broadview Press will have a table, assuming all goes well, we'll have a table at the event where they'll also be selling it, selling that edition as well. So it's really exciting, and we're having an event on the day after the production, somehow. Because we're holding that day for a rain day anyway. So on the day after the production, we're having some more academic gathering, though that's only for registered participants. But Tina will be talking about her work on that day, which is exciting. The order of those days can switch depending on weather. That's our weather contingency plan.
Yeah.
All right, so we talked about text.
We did talk about text. Because it's like we've had such a really, really nice discussion. It's like every so often I go back to a talking point and I just go, that feels a bit basic. So I think we can wrap up. Do you have any sort of final thoughts about what your final hopes for this beyond surviving?
I know, it's so funny. There's such a you said surviving, right? And I think when you said surviving, I think you mean simultaneously, like, how can we make sure no one dies on day of? And how can I make sure I don't have, like, a pulmonary event in organizing it leading up? And there's been this sort of way, like, increasingly people are just naturally, with knowing that I'm organizing this event, will end emails with, and I hope you're okay out there. I hope you're holding up well. I hope you, like, there's this sense of, like, concern for my health and sanity, which is completely founded. Though I've been trying not to kvetch that much about it, because I think it's important to stay positive and it's important to do this. So I think how that ties in is this production, my hope is that it generates energy rather than draining it. I hope it generates more energy than it drains. Generates more energy than it drains. So that energy, and I don't say that in a woo way, I say that in a like literal, like what inspires you to continue to do. I really hope that this event, for all of its participants, and indeed for attendees who are not participants, generates a desire to continue to do and to know by doing. Rather than just read, definitely rather than just watch, I hope that this generates a desire for people to start to explore what entertainment, public entertainment, can be, to at least help the stranglehold that the televisual has on our collective imagination, to at least put a little crack in it, so that people are more inclined to go see and mainly to create for themselves a version of play and dramatic play that can break out of the box, that can do more. I really, really hope that the participants, this is my main hope, I hope that the various participants in York 2025 will continue to do things, both with us at PLS in Toronto and also at all of their home bases. I hope that this generates more performance. Medieval performance, as I'm sure your listeners know, was often striking in its scale. It was occasional, so it happened either really big or really small or anywhere in between. It was something that you could just throw down and do like a basketball game. Which is why so few texts survive, because you don't save the papers from your basketball game that you write down your strategy on or something. I don't know. I'm not really a sports guy. And so, right, unless you're saving it for souvenirs. And so a pickup game of drama is what it was in the medieval period and what we could use a whole lot more of right now. And so I'm hoping that this generates new productions, new collaborations at multiple levels, that people are inspired by it, to stop saying, how could they do it? It's so exhausting. And to start saying, I want more, because I love it. Because I do. I hope you will too.
Yes, because there is good exhaustion as well as bad. There is that sense of you've collapsed the following day, but you're going, God, it was good.
Yeah, yeah. Imagine a life, I mean, you know, we're both theater people. Imagine a life lived without ever doing something that you love so much that it exhausts you. Imagine a life lived without doing that at least once a year. The people in York would not have known that life. I think more people should know it. It's worth it.
So if you are free on Saturday, the 7th of June, 2025, I will repeat the year for future listeners to the podcast, 2025. Do go and catch these mystery plays either on the Saturday or on the Sunday in the event of rain. All the details will be in our show description and are imminently Googleable, or other search engines are available. You can take this as an example as well, just following on from your thought. It's everything that we do is about that thing of going, well, we've done it. Well, you do it. And talking about scalable, just stepping sideways to morality plays, you know, you can do with a couple of people, Mundus et Infants, or you can get a few dozen people together and do the Castle of Perseverance. You can do a small text or a large text. You can engage with it, hopefully between all of the various institutions around the world who are doing this kind of work. There are inns for you to pick up a thread and take it, and take it where you want to take it as well. We're not trying to be prescriptive about how you should work. That's my moral for the end.
No, by doing.
Thank you so much, my wonderful guest, for being wonderful. Thank you very much, and goodbye.
Yeah, farewell to you. Thank you very much.